So if psi transformed to g psi under g, so this is some generic field that wasn't the high energy theory. Then the point is I can construct a field psi twiddle which transforms in this way by using this matrix U. Then psi twiddle, which I'll find to be U in a twiddle is bad, I'm using twiddles in a transformation, but it's called psi. U inverse is that. So under the symmetry transformation, what will happen is that psi hat will go to psi hat twiddle, which I guess I need to write, which will be u of theta twiddle inverse times g psi. But we know what the u of theta twiddle is because the transformation rule here is right here. It's like g times u of theta is equal to u of theta twiddle times this thing here, so this is, if that's u, that's u theta twiddle, that's h, then if I eliminate, this says that u of theta twiddle is equal to g u theta times h inverse, that multiplies through my h inverse. I use that here, so what I'm using is that u theta twiddle inverse. In the inverse of this, it would be h times u inverse of theta times g inverse. So if I put that in here, then I've got the u theta twiddle gh. And if I plug that in, it says h times u inverse theta times g inverse g psi. So g's cancel. U inverse times psi is what I was calling psi hat. This is h times psi hat. So I've constructed from the original transformation rule something which transformed the way I wanted to, because h, the way I'm finding it here, is this u. So there's no loss of generality in writing a transformation like this, because anything that transforms in the ordinary way under G transformation in that full theory, you can multiply through enough Wilson bosons to make it transform in this particular way. So what happened for pi in the special case of pi is kind of a more general state. You can do a field redefinition to make your fields transform in this way. So the more focused statement about the invariant Lagrange is you're trying to make things invariant under H transformations. So under G, we've got G of theta equals to G of theta H, and all the other fields, psi goes to H psi, where by H I mean the specific thing, either the UI of putting on theta and G. Lives in the unbroken group, but it's a position-dependent transformation, so it's not a symmetry. In a way, it's not immediately a symmetry, just because we made a Lagrange transformation. So what we want to do is we're given, so the problem becomes more precisely, if we're given a Lagrangian, which is invariant under global H transformations, how do we make it invariant under global G transformations? And the clue is that we've defined the transformation of G, the action of G on the field, is being expressed in terms of something living in H. And the main difference between this transformation rule, say, and an H transformation, is that this transformation rule is position dependent. Whereas originally we only had a global symmetry H. So we had a rule where the Lagrangian symmetry was invariant under a transformation like this if H had been a constant. But this H, given by this formula, is not a constant because it depends on the Goldman boson fields, which are themselves position dependent. So, but it's suggestive because this is saying that. If you had walked into the room right now and I'd said, well, we have a Lagrangian which is invariant under H, global H transformations, and I want to make it invariant under local H transformations, how would I do that? You would say, oh, well, you have to have a gauge field, you have to look at the gauge field. And that would be the right answer. And so, you know, things involving no derivatives of the field will be, they'll be for free invariant under these H transformations, even though they're local. But things involving derivatives of these fields are going to not want to be invariant under these transformations just because the original Lagrangian was invariant under global H transformations. But we can fix that if we can find a gauge field, gauge potential, whose transformation will cancel the transformation derivative and make and design a covariant derivative for these fields out of this thing. And so the rest of the exercise is what we're going to do is we're going to design a gauge potential out of these Goldstone boson fields themselves. The reason these things depend on position is because they're depending on a position through the potential of the Goldstone boson fields. So what we'll do is we'll build a gauge field out of these Goldstone bosons which will have the transformation property that it cancels the wave derivative transform, or we can define a covariant derivative with that. And then we can make invariant Lagrangians out of these fields psi, just demanding they be locally H invariant, and they will be for free locally H invariant. It can be everywhere we have a derivative will be replaced by a covariant derivative, which is telling you how these things couple to the Goldstone bosons. That's the rule for the psi coupling to the theta. So what I have to do is show you that I can make a Goldstone boson, I can make a gauge field out of these thetas, which transforms the way gauge field would transform, and then we're in business. But then the second thing I have to do is I have to show you how the Goldstone bosons couple to themselves. And so so you might think that what I'm trying to do there is to find a field strength for these gauge bosons, but that's not what I'm trying to do, because the gauge bosons are not spin one particles. We have spin zero particles, and we're going to make a gauge spin one look like looking gauge field out of the spin one particles, but it's really spin one particles. The spin one on S and zero. The vector fields we're going to have, which are going to make a covariant derivatives out of, are just functions of these thetas. So it'll be things like derivatives of theta. That'll be a vector field. So the vector fields we're going to write down are not independent things describing spin one particles. They're just things built out of these fields, which will look like four vectors. And so the kinetic energy for these scalar fields themselves will be the ordinary ones. It'll be just some partial theta times function theta. So what we're going to need there is we're going to need not the field strength for the gauge potential we're going to have constructed, but we're going to need something else. We're going to need to be able to make it a metric out of these things data. So let me tell you why you want to get a metric. So, the idea, and make a Lagrangian L starting with L built out of the size is invariant under L psi is equal to L of H psi. H is constant. So I should call this the case. So let's call this thing H with a flourish. And we can make L be invariant if U and H is not zero. If we replace everywhere partial mu psi is replaced by covariant mu psi, which is the derivative of psi minus I some gauge field, which will look for theta. Okay. So, you know, more details about the thing we talked about is in these notes here. That's kind of where I wrote some of that, so it's a bit easier to see what's going on there. So we have to ask for psi to transform the way gauge field does, right? So we want to have, I'll write that down, we can look at it on the left. Now this, let me just say it, so this is where the delta is not where A mu transforms, so that D mu of psi transformed into H. So when H is curly H, and so it depends on where you are in space-time because it depends on the goals of the boson, psi is always transforming the same way, but the problem with making the invariant Lagrangian, promoting it from a globally invariant one to a locally invariant one, is that the derivative doesn't transform the same way that the original field psi does. Because the derivative sees the fact that H is the derivative. So, you know, if psi goes to h psi, then partial mu psi will go to h times partial mu psi, but also this piece which is partial mu h psi. Right? So that's h times partial mu psi plus h mu h. So what we're looking for is we want to find this A such that the A transformation cancels this in order to make covariant derivative transform exactly the same way the field. Because if we can do that, then any Lagrangian which is a variant under multiplying psi and d mu psi through by constant h will now be invariant for the local function provided that I place the part of everywhere by this covariant. That's the prescription we're going to use to get the everybody except the Golson bosons. For the Golson bosons themselves, what we do is we go back to the kinetic energy for the Golson bosons and ask, we want to do the same thing. We want to ask, what does it take to make the kinetic terms things involving derivatives? So, self-couplings. There it is. Let's do a similar thing. For the derivative field. So, for example, the kinetic term, we know in general it has to be minus 1/2, like, times some function, g, alpha beta is partial mu beta alpha partial mu beta. That's the most general thing with two derivatives. If we want this thing to be invariant under the transformation where delta beta alpha is c alpha, there's some complicated function of theta and some parameter. And we know we just go through the variation of the Lagrangian. There's a piece when I vary this, there's a piece when I vary this, and there's a piece when I vary this. So, all kinetic is invariant with respect to this. So, if we transform this, if it's this, then I'm saying this is. But if theta goes to theta twiddle, which is theta plus c,
yeah. The mu's are not are space time.
Those are space time, yeah. Alpha, yeah. So I'm deliberately keeping the alphas different from the mu's. Yeah, but you're right. So the mu's and nu's and lambdas will be space time, and then alphas and betas are
and g you use like a metric on the group?
So that's what I'm about to show, yeah. So the claim is that so what I want to know is if I do a transformation like this, which is the kind of thing where this depends on theta and on the group element, this is the kind of thing I was working on before, and it's some nonlinear lovely thing. But if I take this thing and ask, I plug this into Lagrangian, I'm going to end up with something involving something of the same form. This is the most general thing I could write with two derivatives, right? If I integrate by parts, I'm going to get something that looks like this again, because I differentiate this with the mu, it's going to be dg d theta times d theta to mu, and I end up with something again with two d theta to mu. So that it's going to be true that if I do this transformation, the Lagrangian will go into something of the same form. So Ln will go into minus 1 half g twiddle L theta. So I go to g twiddle, theta twiddle. Theta. Where you just chase through you just do the variation explicitly. G twiddle alpha beta, maybe G alpha beta. So the simplest one to see is this part. It just vary out to be a plus C gamma, D gamma, and G alpha beta. This one, if I vary this thing, what I'll get is that I'll get a derivative of C with respect to theta. It's pick a mu to the theta, and then the derivative of theta pick a mu, and then if I want to write that in the same form that I had before, I'm good, actually. So I'll have a plus g alpha gamma partial theta gamma plus g gamma theta. And so what you're supposed to recognize is that that shift is what you would have had. If someone had walked in the door now and said, oh, we're talking about this transformation rule and this transformation rule, they would have said, oh, this is some coordinate in space-time that's done some sort of a general coordinate transformation. This is what a symmetric branch two tensor does. So another way of saying, if I do a field redefinition where I change, I redefine scalar fields in some arbitrary way, I didn't have to. Have to be functional omega. Some arbitrary transformation like this, if I ask what happens to the coefficient in the kinetic term, the answer is it transforms in exactly the same way it would have done if I thought of it as being a tensor living on the manifold in which theta takes values. So if theta maps spacetime to some set x, then g alpha beta is transforming under redefinitions of the coordinates in x, which are these field redefinitions, as if it was a symmetric rank 2 tensor living on x. And because the kinetic energy had to be positive, it had to be a positive symmetric rank 2 tensor. So it's something that you couldn't have measured next. So it's symmetric rank 2 with positive. So G, any metric on this space X is something which transforms properly to be a kinetic energy in this environment. And so that shows you that if I can build something which looks like which transforms like a metric under these symmetry transformations I'm talking about, then I will be in business, because then I want to find a metric which is invariant under these transformations, these symmetry transformations. If I specialize this not for an arbitrary transformation, but I think of the symmetry transformations we've been talking about, I want this Lagrangian to be invariant, because I'm trying to make an invariant Lagrangian. And so the goal is I want to find a metric on X, which is invariant on these specific transformations that I've been describing over there for the action of the symmetry group on C. And so this space is G over H. That's where these coordinates live. And so I'm asking for a G invariant metric H, and that's the mathematical problem we're trying to solve. And so the answer will be, what I'll do is I'll construct, in the same way I'm going to construct a gauge field, I'm going to construct basically a fear bind, which will be the thing from which I can make a metric. And so, given those things, I can write down covariance. I can make covariant derivatives for theta, just the same way I made covariant derivatives for these sides. And then the rule will be, build anything you want to those covariant derivatives, and you've got an invariant Lagrangian. Second thing will be, is that the unique answer, and that's, the answer is yes, and you can show one exactly.
you're looking for the killing vector, the vector fields for the metric.
Well, if I had the metric, then I'd be asking for the killing vectors, but I have the killing vectors, so I'm asking for the metric that we
yeah,
use. Yeah, so that's more
like
the
metric is the killing vector.
That's the lead river, yeah. Exactly. So there's a lot of overlap between the techniques of differential geometry and the technique of nonlinear symbol models, these filters we talked about, because of this connection that when you take a typical term in this Lagrangian, which is built out of these things that involve only derivatives, the things you end up getting have a geometrical interpretation in terms of the target space of the symbol model. And so you can use a lot of the people know a lot about how to make invariant metrics on these are called homogeneous spaces. Take over the whole plot. So at this point, if we had been interested in a coset space where G was O3 and H was O2, then geometrically the coset space of O3 divided by O2 is the sphere, two-sphere, where the O2 is the rotation around any one point on the sphere. You can always rotate around the axis going through that point. And the O3 was the set of rotations that leave the two-sphere invariant in three dimensions. And so, in that case, G of H would be a two-sphere, and I'd be asking for what's the metric which is rotation invariant in the two-sphere, and you just write it down. And you say, oh, I know what that is. That's just what we're looking for is that Lagrangian in that case should have been minus 1/2 d mu theta d mu theta minus or plus sine squared theta d mu phi d mu phi. Because the metric 1 sine squared theta in the coordinates, polar coordinates theta phi is the round metric of the sphere, and the action of these coordinates of the rotations, you can tell me, because you can tell me how polar coordinates transform into rotation, and you could read off what all these things are. I'm telling you about it in that particular case. And the uniqueness in the answer is telling you why you don't have to go through this exercise in that case. But you could derive this if you want to. But it's knowing that you're talking about a geometrical thing is often very good because it tells you, you know, there's only one way of doing it. We're just arguing about what coordinates we use to describe it. So now let me just stop talking and do writing. So what I'm going to do is look at the. So consider quantity E inverse theta mu. These are the geometrically, these are the. Under G transmissions, then what happens? We know that U goes to U. If you remember, is the short form for U of theta, and the short form for U e to the I theta alpha x. And similarly, U twiddle, I'll write the short form for U of theta twiddle, which is e to the I theta twiddle x alpha. And then the transformation rule was that GU is equal to U twiddle H, script H. Script H is EDI, UI, PI, or UI function. So we use part of this transform. And so we know that the U inverse, so first of all, U is equal to G inverse U twiddle. U twiddle is equal to G U H inverse. And the transformation rule for this will be under G, U inverse D mu U goes to, well, under G, theta goes to theta twiddle. So this goes to U twiddle inverse D mu U twiddle. And from this, I can read off how that depends on U. So that's just the U inverse to the H, U twiddle inverse. D inverse, and then D mu U twiddle will be. So G doesn't depend on position, H does. This is per H, the one that position because U does. But G, D mu U, H inverse, plus G, U, we know that H inverse is equal to 1, so if I differentiate that, we know that d mu H inverse plus H d mu H inverse is equal to 0. This is true for all values of the parameters in H. So we know that d mu H inverse, myself, I multiply through by H inverse and take this to the right hand side, so minus H inverse d mu H inverse. So I put that in here. And the g's are going to cancel. But h integral inverse d mu u h. So in this term, the u's also cancel. No longer any. The u and u cancel, so we've got the minus. H is going to hit this H inverse minus d mu H. So now the idea is that from this transformation rule, I can define both something which looks like a H exponential, but also something which looks like a Fierbein, from which I can make a metric. So. And what I want to do to identify those two pieces is, remember, what I'm looking for here is something which is associated with an H transformation. So this is going to be something associated with the generators that live in H. What I'm looking for here is something which is associated with the coset guys, G over H. So what I want to do is decompose this transformation rule. This thing, if this is an exponential and I multiply by U inverse, then this is kind of something which is basically like the derivative of the coefficients of the Lie algebra. So this is something which I can think of decomposing into things involving x's and things involving t's, so things in h involving u, things in u over h. And the way to do that decomposition is just to multiply through by the generators x alpha and t alpha and take traces. And that'll start picking off. Because the traces of t's with t's give you something non-zero, the traces of t's with x's give you something zero, that combination will be the things that will transform, those will be the things that will correspond to the things that are transforming like h fields and like that. All right. So let's do that. So define universe d mu to be minus I. A mu theta times I guys in the H direction. And we'll call the guy in the X direction all that. So I'm just defining for you what these guys are. It's just a decomposition of this guy into the directions that are in H and the directions that are in G over H. Given that this is I differentiated a varied U and then I took U inverse, so for an exponential that's picking out something which is on a tangent. This is tangent to the group at the origin, so that's something which lives in the Lie algebra. I can decompose it in terms of t and x. And given the transformation rule for u, I can read off what the transformation rule is for a and for b. So explicitly, I want to invert this for a and e in terms of u. What I would do is I'd say that the a I mu theta will be I. And the trace of ti inverse e mu u, and e alpha mu will be minus I and the trace of x alpha. And in doing this, I'm using that the trace of x alpha, x beta, x alpha, alpha beta, trace of I, j, alpha, j, trace of I, alpha. So if I plug it into the transformation rule and read it off, then what you get is 1. So, this. So under under so the variation of you can kind of see why the other guy who's is the derivative of the parameter is appearing only in here, and this is all living in H. So when I take the trace to pick off the piece in T or in X, this piece, the inhomogeneous piece, is only in the piece that's in the T direction, and so that's why it's only appearing in A. And everybody else has got a piece that's just linear in the thing we built. And so that's great, because this is exactly what we need. So we take this with a transformation for psi, which is I ui t by psi, which is the interpotential transformation that we've been talking about. And that means that the variation of, so if we define d mu psi, the partial mu psi minus I a mu I t I psi, and combining this with this in usual way says that delta of E mu psi is 1 psi E mu psi. And all this inhomogeneous stuff here is canceling the action of the derivative of the transformation. If I differentiate this and take a du term, just canceling that term. So that's what we wanted. We wanted something which this now transforms under the local transformation the same way that the ordinary derivative did under the global transformation. So I've got an invariant around it under global transformations. I promote partial mu psi to d mu psi everywhere, and I've got which is now free invariant for local transformations. And similarly, if I take, if I construct g alpha beta, I define that to be, I think of this as being like a field line. But I think this to be delta alpha, delta. What I want to do is I want to. One more thing. I'll write. What is the definition of A? From this definition, you can see that the mu dependence is coming from a derivative, right? And the only thing that's being differentiated here is the theta, because u is a function of theta. So, A mu, the mu dependence is explicitly always involves a d mu of theta somewhere. So I can always write A mu alpha I as being A alpha I d mu of theta alpha. And we can similarly always write E alpha mu, the E alpha beta, times D mu theta beta. Because of the fact that the mu index is always differentiating these u's, and these u's are just depending on space time all the way through theta. And the reason I'm doing that is that if you're, you know, so if you're differential geometry, then you see that this is something now, this has an index of a space time index. So in this picture where we had space time, and then theta was a map to some target space, x, then A mu was kind of a mixed piece because it has a kind of a group index, but then it has a world index in space-time. So mu and nu are to do with the coordinates here, which are x mu and x nu. The coordinates here are theta alpha and theta beta. So you can't think of this as being a gauge field living on this space. It's really a gauge field living on this space, but it has a natural association with this space because the theta is a map of space to x. And this is telling you about to use that explicitly. This quantity here has no space-time indices in real space-time. It has an index alpha and an index for the group. So this is an object which you can think of as being a gauge field in the space x. And this is what you'd call the pullback of that thing to space-time, using the map from space-time to X. So and similarly for this, this is something which lives, it has an index, which is a field index, alpha, but then it's got a space-time index. Whereas this is something which actually has only indices involving the space X. And so this E alpha beta, transforming the way it transforms here, is what you call a field line on the target space. And with field line, you can always make a metric. So G alpha beta, E alpha gamma, E beta delta, delta gamma delta. And you could have written that as being a trace of X gamma. So the rounding that we're looking for is that G alpha beta take this transformation rule and apply it to that definition. And what does it say? This is saying that we've got this E is transforming as if it's in a representation of H, where the parameter is a representation parameter is U. So this transformation rule is very much like this transformation rule. Right? I've got the variation of something is proportional to U times something. And it just, I don't have a matrix here describing the representation, but this structure constant C is playing that role. So remember, these Gauge bosons were supposed to be, these Poisson bosons are supposed to be in the adjoint representation, sometimes of G. And the adjoint representation is the matrix, is made using representation matrices built from the structure constants, is one way to think about it. And so this EU is the analog of the covariant derivative for the Goldstone bosons, because it's the thing that's transforming like, as if it was transforming linearly under these transformations, even though U is space-time dependent. This EU, which explicitly involves a derivative, is something which is transforming in a homogeneous in a linear fashion. So if you can take any combination it's easy to make invariants out of this, because under a full transformation, this is an infinitesimal transformation. Another way of saying this is that under a full transformation, E alpha mu goes to H E alpha mu E alpha times X alpha. And H inverse. So it's transforming in what I was calling the adjoint representation before. And the way to make things invariant for this is to take products of it and take traces of that. And that'll be something which is automatically invariant. So, in particular, this name is being traced of E mu for E alpha. I could write this thing E alpha gamma X gamma beta delta. So, if I wrote the candidate, if I wrote the combination E mu theta alpha, E mu theta beta. And what is that? That's actually, in that language, that's the trace of E alpha mu x alpha E beta mu, or E mu x beta under E mu. So you can see that we've succeeded in finding something whose transformation is invariant, because if I write this way, which I can use because of these traces, this is a combination of E times generator is transforming homogeneously, and so in that trace, the H inverses all find each other and they kill each other off. And if I want things involving more than two derivatives, and it's clear what I do, this is like covariant derivative, I take many powers of it. Take many phrases as a length, as long as I can track all the instances. So there's 5 minutes left. You might ask, so here's a particular, the same question that arises in gauge theories arises here. You could say, so this is a way of making things invariant. But is this the only way? So if you make things invariant in this way, have you made an assumption that you are not making it explicit? And that's something you want to have clear, because when you're writing an effective Lagrangian, as you've seen, what you want to do is write down the most general thing consistent with the symmetries. Because all possible interactions are going to arise typically consistent with symmetries. So you don't want to be building in hidden assumptions and not finding the most general Lagrangian. And so the answer for this is the same as the answer for the usual gauge theories, that it is the unique thing. And probably better than me going through the argument explicitly, unless you really want to see it, is to go take a look at this view, which makes it explicitly. And more or less what you do is you take the action as a function of fields and the derivatives, and you explicitly vary it. And you say the conditions for invariance are that because the invariance has to be an identity in X, that means that the, let me write the first line and you can see the rest of it, and then you want the it's unique up to these things. These things, maybe you have a few parameters in these things. For many cases, these things are unique up to normalization. But so if I could take this invariant Lagrangian, I could always multiply it by a number and get another correct Lagrangian. So it's often true that there's only the freedom to normalize this thing. And that justifies the statement I told you about the Boltzmann boson, the finest Boltzmann boson. I told you that all the nonlinearities, finding the interactions involving two derivatives was dictated by symmetries. And this is the argument. In that case, the group involves the symmetric is unique, and so there's only a normal normalization to fool with. But sometimes, if the group is not big enough, there might be more than one metric that's invariant of the symmetry. Then you can get a linear combination of those metrics here. So there might be several parameters that appear, but it depends on the detail of the group. So I'm not arguing whether that parameter depends. I'm asking, was there a loss of generality in building things out of these objects, these emus, and these amus, and the size. So if you have a Lagrangian, which is built out of psi, and derivatives of psi, and theta, let's give the argument for gauge fields, and then it's the same kind of argument for these guys. Supposing you had an emu, and what you want to demand is that this thing is identically equal to zero. Under delta psi is equal to I omega A psi delta A U is the usual thing. The point is, this has to be, this is identically zero for all values of the fields and the parameters. So what I can do is I can explicitly differentiate it and follow the parameters, and I can separately set to zero the coefficients of the parameter undifferentiated and the parameter differentiated. Because those are independent variables that I'm allowed to take arbitrary functions. So this statement is that 0 is equal to dl psi I omega a psi plus dl emu psi times emu omega psi. A plus 3. Right, so that's just, I just differentiated and then use the transformation rules. And what I can do now is group this as being something times omega A plus something times d mu omega A plus something times d mu d nu omega A. And it has to be identically zero for any choice of omega, for which I can independently vary the value of omega, the derivative of omega, and the second derivative of omega. That means these coefficients have to all identically vanish. And so the thing is, if you look at this thing will vanish because its derivative is symmetric. This will vanish as long as this thing is anti-symmetric mu nu. And that basically says that you have to build, whenever you see a d mu a, it has to appear in f a mu nu, which is d mu a, d mu a nu, d mu a mu, plus c of mu. So that's the condition that this thing vanishes. This thing vanishing is a condition that whenever you see a d mu psi, it's appearing together with a minus I a A sign. So that just says wherever you see a derivative, it has to be a covariant derivative. And this being invariant is a condition that the thing was invariant for global symmetries because omega is not differentiated. So the statement, this argument shows you that the algorithm of making an action invariant by taking derivatives and replacing it by covariant derivatives and taking gauge fields and replacing their derivatives with field strengths is the most general way in which you get to make this thing true because you can derive it by starting from the invariants. And so a similar thing, which is different in a little bit of detail, because these A's are now functions of thetas, and they transform a little bit differently, makes the case that the condition for invariance for Lagrangian under these transformations, under this, the original transformations theta and psi, is mount to the requirement that everywhere you have derivative, you place it by covariant derivative, the way I constructed it, and everywhere you have a kinetic term, you're building a invariance of these derivatives. So it's unique. So just before you go, the bottom line is this, that if you have a symmetry breaking pattern, H goes to G, G goes to H for global symmetry, then at low energies, the general form, low energies compared to that symmetry breaking, the general form of the Lagrangian is, Lagrangian itself has to be invariant under global H transformations, because that was the statement that you didn't break H. But then for free, you can make it invariant under G transformations by coupling the Goldstone bosons appropriately. And how do you do that? Well, everywhere you have a Goldstone boson, everywhere you have a derivative for matter, you're supposed to couple, promote it to a covariant derivative, and so the fields, all the other fields besides the Goldstone bosons are coupling to the Goldstone bosons through these covariant derivatives. And the Goldstone bosons themselves coupling to one another through the geometry of the target space built from this spherefine, which gives you the field number, which is the metric of the target space. So the symmetry is telling you how the Goldstone bosons couple to one another, and it's telling you how the other fields couple to the Goldstone bosons, and the only content in the G invariance above the H invariance is in how the Goldstone bosons couple. The only restrictions on the Lagrangian are coming from this, that the variation of the Lagrangian had to be chosen so that this thing is vanishing, and that's the statement that it was invariant under global H transformations. So it's only the unbroken groups that are restricting the form of the Lagrangian, and then the extra information coming from the G invariance is all to do with how the Goldstone bosons come. So I was going to, rather than doing an exercise, what I'll do is I'll sign the simplest exercises in SE2-1 where you can be explicit about everything because you can take advantage of the exercise of you know, E to the I, A dot Pauli matrix, you know, is cosine of A, I sine of A, A hat Pauli matrix, where A is you know, the norm, A squared is B dot A, and A hat is A divided by. So this is the unit vector in the A direction, and this is the norm of A. And this kind of construction allows you to be really, really, everything I did with exponentials, and I had to give you linear transformation, you just write the whole thing out, because the Pauli matrices, these exponentials you can write in terms of linear things about Pauli matrices. That's a very useful exercise because it's one that is applies to pions. So the coupling to pions, nucleons, and protons. This is an example, and it's a really useful exercise to do when you calculate all these different steps. So that would be, I think, part of the assignment. But it's better that you do it than see me do it. So I'll see you guys at 2:30.